Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. How's it going? What are we, in month 7 of this shit? How are you? Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. How's the exercise going? How's the walk? How's your dog? How's your kid? How's your leg? How's your hand? How's your fucking head? Are you using whatever options you have at your disposal to maintain your sanity without hurting yourself or others? Are you trying to mind your mind so they don't mine your mind? Do you know what a mark is? Do you know what a mark is? Not me. A mark. The intended victim of a swindler, hustler, or the like. A mark, an object of derision, scorn, manipulation, or the like. Example, he was an easy mark for this Trumpian bullshit. Marks, a nation of marks. Why am I bringing that up? Why am I bringing that up? I tell you, man, President alluded to leaving the country if he loses. Good riddance. If he can't maintain power and continue to degrade the nature of the rule of law as we drift further into authoritarianism, don't email me, you know, the three fucking Trump supporters who listen to me. Don't email me with your fucking delusional bullshit about what's really happening. Don't do it. It's not my fault that you're a mark, that you didn't mind your mind, or that you're so myopic that your ability to contextualize or see through the veil of garbage is muted or destroyed. Wouldn't it be beautiful if he loses and then moves the entire operation and family to Russia where he can be protected? Wouldn't it be the best thing in the world if this motherfucker lived in exile in Moscow? He's got a lot of debt, got a lot of charges hanging over his head. I love that story. That's the best possible ending as the world ends. Patty Smith is on the show today. Patty fucking Smith is on the show today. Patty Smith. Are you fucking kidding me? When was the last time you listened to her first three albums in a row? She's got her latest book out, Year of the Monkey. It's now available in paperback. You might have read some of her other stuff, Just Kids and Devotion and a few other books. But she's here, and I've been wanting to talk to her for a while. And she's here. I am her first Zoom interview. I was her first Zoom call. Patty Smith was a Zoom virgin before me. And I'm thrilled to have had that honor. And you'll hear me talking to Patty. I just love her. She's the real fucking deal. She is the one and only Patty Smith. She's the raw goods, man. all there all the time, right up front. Fucking love her. True beatnik legacy. That's what I was trying to get at. There's no context anymore, really. History is dissolving. Everything is all the time. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted. That's not true. That's an old riff on a Hassan Asaba bit that Burroughs used to do. And then Jim Carroll did it in a song. I can't think like that, but the context of history is diminished when everything happens all the time and no one is educated properly, no one is really schooled in critical thinking or civics or even American history in a proper way, global history, myself included. It's just all there all the time. Nobody knows who did what or what anyone's importance was in the context of history. The big monsters and the do-gooders, nobody knows really how they fit in. It's a generation of young people who might say, yeah, you know, oh, Hitler, the guy with the mustache, right? That's the context. But history is being diminished. And that's why, on some level, I was happy to talk to Patty because she comes directly from the New York that was still being occupied by a beatnik idea, that was still being occupied by artists sort of like really pushing the envelope. That first wave of performance artists, the first wave of punk, you know, in the sort of like the beaten up city of the early 70s, stuff was forming, things were happening. There was no internet. Everything was raw and dirty. Yeah. That history. But she is a direct legacy. She knew Burroughs. She knew Ginsberg. They both took her under their wing. She was friends with Mapplethorpe. She dated Sam Shepard, Tom Verlaine. But she was there in the cauldron of that stuff in the 70s when those old timers were kind of fading out a bit but still had some wisdom to share. Because I wanted to be part of the beatnik legacy. I respected that history. I was a hero worshiper, even though I didn't quite understand it. And I don't think any of those people exist anymore. The people that sort of worship these times. Is it nostalgia? Is it wanting to live in the past? Or is it honoring the arc of history and where you land in it and where you come from? When I was in college, I was like all up in it. Reading the books about the beatniks, reading the beatnik books, reading the beatnik heroes. Arthur Rimbaud, Baudelaire, Blake. Ginsberg was a Blake guy, a Rimbaud guy. They were all Rimbaud guys. Patti Smith's a Rimbaud woman, a Blake woman. That poetic legacy, the poetic journey of that particular type of poetry. Shatter your senses, man. Break it all down. Like, I got some quotes here from these people. From Rimbaud, the poet, therefore, is truly the thief of fire. He is responsible for humanity, for animals, even. He will have to make sure his visions can be smelled, fondled, listened to. If what he brings back from beyond has form, he gives it form. If it has none, he gives it none. A language must be found of the soul for the soul and will include everything, perfumes, sounds, colors, thought, grappling with thought. Arthur Rimbaud, hero of Patti Smith, hero of the Beats, hero of Ginsberg. I always feel like I don't get it. I always thought there was more there that I didn't understand it. How do I crack this fucking code? And then you kind of lighten up with it. Just take it in. Take what you can get. The Beats. The mark. Burroughs was a great comedian and a great philosopher. And I think he said something very relevant. My favorite Burroughs quotes apply directly to what we're living through. Like this one from Naked Lunch, I think. The junk merchant doesn't sell his product to the consumer. He sells the consumer to his product. He does not improve and simplify his merchandise. He degrades and simplifies the client. God bless America. Here's a direct message to the piece of shit president of the United States we have currently. quote, hustlers of the world, there is one mark you cannot beat, the mark inside, end quote. The mark, the intended victim of a swindler, hustler, or the like. That's from the dictionary. My point being, there was a progression. There was a progression from the beatnik idea through the poetry of Patti Smith, through the playwriting of Sam Shepard, on into punk rock. And Burroughs was dug in New York for a while. But, you know, Patti broke out. There's nobody like Patti Smith, but she was shaped and molded in the cauldron of fucking poetic art, the vision of Rimbaud. I remember when I came home from college one year, I went into the Living Batch bookstore where my mentor Gus Blaisdell presided. He was the proprietor. And there was a poster on the wall for some sort of big shindig up in Naropa. This must have been in the 80s, the early 80s, at that beatnik school. Yeah, I think it was the Naropa Institute. I remember seeing this poster and they were all going to be there, all the living beats at that time. You know, Burroughs, Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, maybe Creeley. I don't know who was there. Ann Waldman. They were all going to be there. And I was such a fucking fanboy, man. I said to Gus, I said, I got to get up there and see that. He goes, what do you want to hang around with those geriatrics for? Do your own thing, man. And I'm like, yeah, but they were great. Like, I knew those guys. And then he made a joke. I didn't want to believe it was a joke. Maybe it wasn't a joke, but he said, yeah, I met Kerouac once at a party in San Francisco. He was sitting on the floor in the corner, drunk, with vomit on his shirt, talking to Neil Cassidy, saying, live like a tree, Neil. Live like a tree. But that was Gus, man. He was a funny motherfucker. Changed my head, changed my mind, changed my heart. But I've been to the places. I've been to the graves. I've worshipped at the altars. And I come out, here I am. This is it. So now I got Patti Smith here. Just so fucking excited about it. Seriously. I was her first Zoom. I hope it went well. I hope she enjoyed it. Right? Huh? Her third and latest memoir is called Year of the Monkey. It's now available in paperback wherever you get books. And this is me and Patti Smith doing her first Zoom. Dig it. What's your cat's name?
Cairo.
Oh, look at that.
She's 19 years old, and she's a bit infirmed, and she doesn't like to be separated from me, so I'm going to have to let her sit here if it doesn't bother you.
No, it's great. I just had to I just had to put down a 16-year-old.
I'm sorry.
It's terrible. Jeez. And his sister went about 6 months ago, and then I have this other one who's about four. So I got one left.
Well, she's the last of the three we had. So, but she's a little Abyssinian runt. She was born really small, kicked out of the litter box, or kicked out of the mama's box. And they didn't think she'd last very long, and she's 19. So
the runts are tough.
That's right. I wasn't a runt, but I was pretty scruffy. I was a scrawny thing.
You seem pretty tough pretty early on.
Yeah. I mean, I was... people would say I was sickly because I was sick all the time. But in the 50s, you had everything. Measles, chickenpox, scarlet fever, mumps,
yeah,
tuberculosis as a toddler. I mean, back then you got everything and two kinds of measles. But it didn't necessarily mean that you were a sickly child. It just meant that you were negotiating all of the things that came out at you. So I'm pretty good at negotiating those type of things. So, you know, I'm hoping that will give me extra strength in our present situation.
Ooh, what a situation it is, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, just you know, having been through so many different kinds of illnesses, I know, and this one seems extremely troublesome, unpredictable, potentially dangerous. So I've been respecting it. I've had my talk with it and said, all right, I respect you. I'm 73. I have a little bronchial condition. I'll be prudent. And even though I'm restless and agitated, I'll be prudent. And I do what I'm supposed to be doing. So that's all I can do.
That's good. Well, I like this. You said in one of these epilogues, you said a psychic nausea that we were obliged to work off in every way available. A psychic nausea that we had. That's every day.
Well, the psychic nausea that I was speaking of then, because I wrote that very early, was our situation in terms of our government.
Right.
I was really talking about our political situation and what we have to deal with daily. But I, you know, of course, that melded with, as you said, you know, we're dealing with a pandemic that makes us deal with things not only mentally, but physically.
Yeah, no, it's all combined.
But I do try to keep busy. I try to keep busy as possible.
I've been saying use whatever option you have at your disposal to maintain your sanity without hurting yourself or others.
Yes, that's I like that. That's good. And also do things that benefit you. I mean, it benefits me being alone in my house. I'm quite messy. So it benefits me to become more disciplined, to be neater, to clean up after myself, to shed things. It has benefited me to be, more domestically aware, even though I didn't really want to. And I don't like staying put. But I feel better. I feel like my surroundings are healthier. They're, they give me more space to think.
Yeah.
So something like that, you know, just we all have to do whatever we can to survive emotionally, physically, and
psychologically.
Yeah, psychologically.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's been interesting for me because spending this type of time with yourself, it's not really challenging, but it is revealing. You know, I mean, in the book and in some of your other work, I mean, as a poet or as an artist, you know, you're sort of your job, part of your job is to reflect and spend time, you know, meditating on life and whoever you are in relation to the world and your expression. But now you really find out what you're made of in terms of emotional survival, psychological survival, you know, what's important to you. And it's amazing how that list of things that you think are important to you gets smaller when you spend this type of frightened time alone, you know?
Well put. I mean, really, I mean, I am used to being on my own. I'm used to traveling and being on my own all over Europe or while I'm working or away from my band. I like my solitude. I'm not that social. I like to write on my own, but that's in motion.
Yeah.
Being stationary alone is a lot different. And I have found that challenging. So as you said, I've had to really go into myself and get to know what I'm like in this particular scenario.
Yeah.
It has been challenging, but I've learned a lot. I feel healthier. I'm attending to myself. I'm doing my own cooking. And trying to develop new disciplines. But I find that I pace a lot, talk to myself more than usual.
Well, I mean, it seems like when I look at your life, I mean, like there's this idea, you know, that there's some precedent for the type of chaos or for how bad this country can get. But it seems to me that you grew up in the 50s, but you got to New York, in the late 60s, right?
Yes.
So it must have been insane, right?
Well, I mean, for me, it was exciting because I lived in a very rural area of South Jersey. And just to see people on the streets was exciting, you know, to see all these stores, to see so many bookstores, so many possibilities for work. That was one of the exciting things. There was no work for a 20-year-old in South Jersey or in Philadelphia because there was a huge shutdown of the New York shipyard in Camden.
Yeah.
30,000 people lost their jobs, and there were no real jobs for young people. So New York was, for me, you know, it was like a gold mine. It was a down and out city like myself at the time, 1967. The city was nearly bankrupt. It was very cheap to live in New York City then. There were hundreds, it seemed, of bookstores, places to get a job. People on the streets were, you know, didn't bother you. There was things to see everywhere, museums. It was amazing to me.
So it didn't feel like I saw some documentary footage of you, not, you know, with Robert, but also in, you know, I don't know what the interview was. I think it was in an Adam Curtis documentary, you know, about New York. But I always get the feeling that, you know, which is maybe wrong, that it felt chaotic and frightening. But that wasn't the sense you got.
Oh, no, I was never frightened in New York.
Yeah.
I was excited. I mean, because, I mean, New York had its dangerous areas. There were areas back then that you just didn't go into. You didn't go down all the way down Avenue C in the East Village.
Or, right.
You know, there were certain areas that you stayed out of. But I found all of the action exciting.
Yeah.
People on the streets. I mean, in the parks, there were all these people protesting and singing and playing chess. And you didn't see that where I came from. It was exciting. I mean, I never was harmed. In fact, it was a lot scarier walking down a dirt road at night and passing the pig farms in South Jersey in 1967 than walking through the East Village. That's for sure.
Well, I always felt that too. I always felt the safest in New York, because at any point and any time you could walk outside and there'd be people.
And, yes.
Right. And there'd be people that if something went down, someone was going to step in and go, oh, whoa, whoa, no, you can't do that. You know, someone was going to help out.
Yeah, I felt I've never been harmed in New York City. Never been harmed by another person. And, you know, I flourished here. I mean, New York has much changed, and it's not the New York that I knew when I was young, but I feel very grateful to it.
Well, it seems like I was thinking about, like, you know, how to, you know, frame a conversation or to think about your work or you know, how you kind of became who you are, is that you're kind of like, there's your generation, this sort of, you know, beatnik legacies, and the people that sort of came, like the type of environment that created the art that your generation came from, that you came from, it was really the last one like that. I mean, it just, there was such a creative kind of newness to things. There was like risks to be taken, and there was a sort of rock and roll / beatnik ethic to it all, and a sort of desire to push buttons even further. And it was also earnest, and it seemed like a small community, and you still had some of the old guys around.
Yeah. Well, we were all... that's so nicely said. I feel like I should just be listening to you. You're much more articulate than I've been lately. But, well, I think also we were all bred on rock and roll.
Right.
We were post-war kids. We wanted new things. We didn't want the same, you know, we didn't want the things our parents desired, which was safety, security, or their little house, and, you know, nothing wrong with the things that they wanted. We wanted something different. I wanted to be free of all of that. I didn't want to have things set up for me. I didn't want to be a secretary or a hairdresser or a homemaker. I wanted to see what else was out there. And the nice thing about New York at that time, there were kids from all over America who came like-minded. We were all listening to the same music. We all, you know, our causes were the same, you know, whether it was, you know, human rights, gay rights, civil rights, the war in Vietnam. We had our causes and our loves were in tandem. So, you know, you felt kinship wherever you went. And even the people that were more well known when I lived at the Chelsea, you know, any given moment, Janis Joplin or the Allman Brothers or Jimi Hendrix or, and all these people would walk in. And the only thing that separated us all was they had bigger rooms or they had more money to spend at the bar. We all dressed the same. You know, we had similar cadence in our speech. We all would get to know each other. It wasn't the cult of celebrity the way that it is now. It was more like, that's such and such, and he's done this.
Yeah.
You know, he's created these songs that we're singing or that has really inspired us. It wasn't, people weren't taking people's pictures and asking for autographs. We all sort of lived together.
There's a community of creative people pushing the envelope.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know, like, cause I'm 50, I just turned 57. So like, you know, a lot of this stuff for me coming into it and being in college and, you know, kind of being obsessed with the Beats and then getting obsessed with the next generation of artists that, that you were part of. And, you know, by the time I, you know, spent any time at the Chelsea, you know, it was not, it was just a mythological place almost, you know?
Well, that's funny because it was almost when I went there in 69 with Robert, people were saying that about it then.
Oh, because, it was over?
Well, because you didn't have people like Bob Dylan and Edie Sedgwick and Dylan Thomas, and the people before us had left or died. But the people that were still there were pretty good. We were more of the early rock. We were the rock and roll generation.
Who was there?
Shirley Clarke lived there. Harry Smith was there. You'd see Arthur C. Clarke. Salvador Dali came in and out. Janis Joplin lived there for a while, and Leonard Cohen and all kinds of musicians stayed there. You go into the bar next door and you'd see whoever was playing would be at the El Quixote, but they were just there, and I lived there, so they were in my house. And William Burroughs, and I remember sitting at the bar, at the El Quixote bar, because we were working on a project with William Burroughs. And it was William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg and Carl Solomon and Dennis Hopper. And then Sam Shepard came in, and it was just another night. You know,
wow.
Terry Southern, he was writing a script for William. Uh-huh. We were going to do a version of Junkie.
Oh, really?
And I was going to play Mary. But it all fell apart. But for a while, just hanging out with them was pretty great.
I can't imagine. When I read this book, you know, the new or the one that's coming out in paperback now, Year of the Monkey. I mean, it seems like you were sort of straddling some of the stuff that Burroughs did, you know, moving between reality, not reality, dream, not dream, you having guides, you know, and. Because like when all this shit started to go down, for some reason, I went back to Burroughs to try to decode some stuff. Because in my life, I always feel like it's all in there somewhere. That, you know, all the answers are within Burroughs somewhere. You just have to figure out how to find them and sort it out from some of the other science fiction and weirdness.
He believed it was all out there. It was all out there. And he believed also, if you were lucky enough to have suffered scarlet fever, which both him and I had, you had an open channel for all of these things to come from this great pool. So what you were getting from William, he was a good portal, because William got all of those things from everywhere else. He believed in that. So he was the right guide for you.
So the scarlet fever created the ability?
Well, he believed that it didn't create the ability, but that it opened the portal wider. In the Wild Boys, Gianni and the Wild Boys had scarlet fever. We had a club, me and William, called the Scarlet Fever Club. And but he really believed that if you had suffered a really deep fever at a very young age, it opened your portal forever.
That's interesting. Yeah, I started to plow into the Western lands, you know, which it seemed to me that I think that maybe you're dealing with a bit of it too, that like he had to somehow reckon with mortality in a very sort of a practical way for himself. And it seemed like, you know, his interpretation of the Book of the Dead was how he was going to go about it. Is that true?
Oh, I suppose I've never analyzed. I've never thought about it.
Oh.
I mean, to me, I mean, that's the kind of thing you'd have to talk. I just read his stuff, you know?
Yeah, me too. But like, I wanted answers somehow. And like, I had to keep going back because structurally he's a little tricky for me. But like, you know, when I started to see that he was dealing with all these different levels that once the person dies, goes through, and he created characters with names for each of those levels that were very Burroughs-y characters, I was sort of able to figure out, oh, this is the journey, man. You know, so it was a little...
Huh? You think deeper than I do. I mean, to me, William, sometimes reading William or reading certain writers is like listening to Coltrane or something, or a saxophone solo.
Right.
I never analyze it. I'm just there and I just go with them and I go all the way as far as they're going to take me. And then I come back and don't even remember where we've been because I'm so immersed in the going.
I think that's right. I think that's the best way to do it. I always assume like I'm missing something.
No. I mean, he's got so many blanks there.
Yeah.
He wants you to fill in. I mean, you have to be the third mind with William.
Right.
Because I remember one of William's great disappointment in himself was that he couldn't write a straight-laced detective story or a straight-laced novel. And we talked about this, all of these books, if you think about it, they start very conventionally.
Yeah.
Think you're going with this old guy sitting there with his, you know, shotgun on a barrel or something. You're going to go straight through some plot with him. And then he starts cutting things up and going into several layers of worlds. And he told me he just couldn't help it. That's the way his mind works, and that's his process. He would have loved to have written even a two-bit detective novel, that's for sure.
I've read his essays, and it's interesting when he writes with that type of clarity or you read the interviews. But like, yeah, and I get it. There's a magic to it. You guys, I mean, you're a magician as well. There is a magic to this idea of transcending space and time, you know, through cut-ups and through, you know, I mean, I get it, and I like it. So you were able to spend time with Burroughs early on, you know, before you started singing or as a poet?
Oh, yeah. I met him in 1970, I think. I met him. I had a big crush on him. So I was always...
you know how to pick him.
He would come into the Chelsea Hotel and he was so handsome and he was always so well-dressed. And I just had the biggest crush on him. And I would try to... You know, I would talk to him and I think he was amused by me.
Yeah.
And but also he got to trust me. He I don't know. We became friends. But also sometimes in the course of a night, William would get extremely disheveled because he'd come into the Chelsea and you had to come through the lobby and then go through this door into the bar.
Yeah.
He would start out with his, you know, perfect tie and suit and overcoat. And then when he left, he was a bit stumbly. He'd get a bit intoxicated and I would wait. And then I would get him a cab and make sure that, you know, he didn't leave anything behind and just, you know, be his like little guardian angel girl.
Oh, that's sweet.
We just got to be friends and friends throughout his whole life and right to the end of his life. And he was a very kind and very principled man. I know people know all different aspects of William.
Yeah.
And he was many things. And, but to me, he was very good to me. He was a good teacher. When my husband died, he was, so supportive. He was kind to my children. You know, I loved him.
Well, I feel a lot. I mean, that's one thing that comes through the writing and your life is that like the sort of amazing, deep, and you know, lasting friendships is really it's like enviable. I mean, you know, when the way you talk about William and the way you talk about Sam Shepard in the book, just these, you know, this real appreciation of friends and people you love and other artists that you respect. It's just, it really struck me because I don't. I think things have become kind of chaotic and odd, and I guess people still do it. But when I look at my life, I have a few friends, but there's such, because you, the generation and the people that you guys, the crew of you are so, you know, daunting in your output and in who you were in the world. I just love that you're not only are you friends, but you stay together until the end. I mean, it's really kind of amazing, and it really is what life is about. I mean, at least half of it, right?
Well, you find a few people that you really trust, who you feel understand you. I was just lucky. The people that I was close to as a young girl and remain close till, you know, their passing, we had, all of us had work-centric relationships as well as sometimes romantic relationships.
Right.
Robert Mapplethorpe was my boyfriend. And, but when we, you know, had to, you know, transition our relationship, we had so much to salvage. Our, you know, our mutual respect for each other, the work that we did with each other, how we trusted each other's opinion, how comforted we felt by each other. And so there was no reason to, you know, tear our friendship apart. We had to work very hard, but we saved it. And the same with Sam and I. Sam was my boyfriend when I was young.
Yeah.
And that was quite an exciting period, but we also worked together, but we had a great trust and great communication, and the friendship that we had and that aspects of that working relationship and that trust were way more important than, you know, a romantic relationship. If that's not what you're destined to have, there's often even a greater jewel,
you know,
there if you recognize it and work to keep it alive. And we did.
Yeah, it's beautiful, and it's sort of. Early on, the only way I could picture you two at that time was by actually, you know, reading or seeing a production of Cowboy Mouth. And I was like, wow, that seemed exhausting.
writing that with Sam was the easiest thing. I mean, it was this, Sam and I decided mutually that we would part.
Yeah.
He did have a family, and it was the right thing to do, but we were sad. But one night he just said, we were in the Chelsea Hotel, and he said, let's write a play.
Yeah.
Let's not sit and weep. Let's write a play. And I said, I don't know how to write a play. It was like, you know, doing Zoom. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And so he said, well, I'll set up a scenario and you be your character and I'll be my character.
Yeah.
So he set up a scenario, and then he started writing, and when it was my time to talk, he would just hand me the typewriter. We were sitting on a bed, and he would slide over the typewriter, and then I would write my part.
Yeah.
And then I would slide it back, and we wrote a play.
And
it was just, it had a naturalness to it, but both of us being, you know, lovers of language, you know,
yeah,
a lot of language in it too.
It's just so, like, you know, these reflections in this book, you know, particularly, like, I don't know all the books specifically, but, you know, I've kind of immersed myself in the music. You know, yesterday I listened to the last album you did, which was great. And I listened to the first four and kind of in the middle and picking up pieces here and there and then looking at the gaps. And I'm like, what was going on there? I just do a lot of thinking before I talk to
someone. Yeah, no kidding. You stopped me in my tracks a couple of times.
I did, in a bad way?
No, in a good way. I was like, you know, especially when you were talking about William and where the different layers and levels you were going. I was just like, again, I just went with you, and then you asked me a question about what you said, and I was like, huh? I just, like, I was off with you, man. I wasn't analyzing what you were saying.
I can do that with jazz, man. I can do it with jazz.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it's all about. Improvisation. It's the miracle of improvisation.
I can lock into that stuff, you know, but, like, I think there's some part of me that, Like, I guess it's not about craving answers, but it is sort of about making sense. You know what I mean? And like, you know, and I'm looking to him to make sense. You know, control needs control to survive. You know, like, I'm like, what does that mean? You know, so, but that's me, man.
He was a lover of Rimbaud, too. And it's like, the whole idea was to explode the senses. You know, it was, I mean, think about it, with doing cut-ups and all of the things he was doing.
Yeah.
He was always looking for new things. William was looking for like a new language, a new alphabet, you know, some new aspect of the psyche. But he wasn't really looking to make sense. A part of him did crave to write the straight detective story. But when he was writing, he was looking for things. He was looking for something that no one had said before, no one had seen before, because that to William was what an artist did.
Right. That makes sense. So like, yeah, Rimbaud's another one. Like, you know, the championing of Rimbaud that you do and like Jim Carroll, like there are people that do it. The Beats do it. Like that brought me to Rimbaud. And again, like I was like, do I just take this stuff at face value? And you do, because the images are mind blowing. That's what you're looking for, right?
I've never been an analytical person,
yeah,
but things do speak to us. I mean, I was like 11 years old when I saw cubism,
yeah,
for the first time,
right?
Art for the first time. Cubism spoke to me at 11 years old. Jackson Pollock spoke to me at 11 years old. I can't say why. I mean,
yeah,
one could say, well, it's the time of rock and roll. Maybe it was the, you know, that 50s energy. But I've never really been able to, or even sought to analyze why things have spoken to me, why Rimbaud spoke to me. I didn't even understand his poems when I was like 15, but their beauty just captivated me. I didn't care about what they meant.
Yeah.
Now it seems it's not so difficult to comprehend what he's laying out. But back then it was like, you know, reading Wittgenstein.
Yeah.
The world is everything that is the case. You know, what does that mean? Well, I don't know, but I'm there. You know, I'm there with you, man. I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm right with you.
Yeah, I wrote something down once that said, you know, I don't know what it means, but when I'm reading it, it feels like I'm thinking it.
Yeah, yeah. Who said that?
Me.
Oh, well, see, there you go again. Yeah, that is a cool statement. And I know exactly what you're talking about. I like that.
It's,
yeah,
it's just like, it's like feeding it, you know, and then, you know, something reconfigures something in your brain, whether you understand it or not.
Well, and sometimes, like, do we understand music?
Yeah.
You know, you listen to, you know, Hendrix or Beethoven or something, and, you know, you don't need to break it down if it like speaks to you or makes you weep or just makes you feel, you know, like you could conquer the universe. There's, you know, what's to analyze?
You got to let it happen. Yeah, there's no, I'm not great at analyzing things, but when I feel, I just always assume that I don't like understand certain things. But, you know, as you get older, those things become fewer and less important. That's for fucking sure. That, you know.
Well, there's another way to look at that. How great it is that there's still stuff out there we don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
It's just more exciting, more adventure. If we understood everything, you know, then it would, you know, might get a little boring. But I love when things beguile me.
You know,
I can look at, like, one of the things I love to do is look at, like, geometry books or higher math books that have all kinds of diagrams in them.
Mm.
I don't know what it is, but it's so beautiful. And the language of mathematics is so beautiful. I've never been able to figure it out, but I'm endlessly entertained by it.
Yeah, I am no good at math either.
You hear that?
Good. Yeah, what is it? What's going on out there?
It's a thing they're doing now. People put their car radios up to as loud as possible and open the windows and sing.
Oh, well, you know, people are kind of crawling out of their skin. They need some
it's
relief.
Like becoming a thing. I know it's becoming a thing because I sometimes see the same cars circling.
Oh, you know, doing it?
I think they're, you know, hoping they'll be discovered.
Oh, really?
By me, yeah. Just being a pain in the ass. But you know, happy that they're having a good time.
What about Ginsburg? When did you meet Ginsburg?
I met Alan again right near the Chelsea Hotel. And I had written about this in Just Kids. I met Alan. I knew who Alan Ginsberg was, of course.
Yeah.
And I actually think I learned about Alan Ginsberg through Bob Dylan, it seems to me.
Right.
I had never met him. And then I think probably early 1971 or somewhere in 1970, I was going to the Automat and to get a sandwich. And I was really hungry. And Robert and I had hardly any money. And I didn't have enough money. I just had enough money for a sandwich. So I put the money in and I went to get my sandwich out. And it wouldn't open because they had upped the price from like 55 cents for this cheese and mustard sandwich to 65 cents.
Yeah.
So I was like devastated because I was so hungry.
Yeah.
And I hear this voice behind me and I was dressed like I had a long overcoat on and a like a Mayakovsky cap, you know. And
yeah.
It's kind of cool looking. I mean, I was like 22 or something. And this guy says, can I help? And I turned around and it's Allen Ginsberg. And I was like, wow. And I just like this. And he put a dime in. I got my sandwich. And then he went and got me a cup of coffee. And then he sat with me and I was like speechless. I thought, geez, Allen Ginsberg is like getting me food and coffee. And then he starts talking away to me. And then finally I answer him. He was talking about Camden and I'm from that general area. So I started talking about Walt Whitman.
Yeah.
And he looked and he goes, are you a girl? And I've already read this, but since you're asking me, and I said, it's a true story. And I said, yeah, is that a problem? And he went, oh, no. I'm sorry. I thought you were a very pretty boy. And I figured out what was happening. So I asked him, I said, well, do I have to give you back the sandwich or, you know, can I keep the coffee?
Yeah.
And he started laughing. He said, no, it was my mistake. And then we just hit it off. We kept talking about Walt Whitman, but he had come to my rescue because he thought I was,
right.
I was often mistaken for because I didn't wear makeup or anything like that. I just had an androgynous look, I suppose.
Yeah.
So it was, that's how Alan and I met. And we, it's funny because I met William because I was trying to pick him up.
Yeah.
And which was equally fruitless because when William realized I was trying to pick him up, he said, my dear, I'm a homosexual. I don't care. That's okay. But both of these men really were such, for me, great teachers and great friends. I mean, really, again, when my husband died in 94 and I had two small children, had to come back to New York, I was really at the lowest point in my life. It was Alan who came. Alan came right to my rescue, drew me back into working again, actually talked to Bob Dylan to ask Bob to maybe take me on a tour, help me get work.
Yeah.
So these men, you know, I met these men both in 1970 in humorous circumstances, but they were lifelong friends.
So when you started to do, like, it seemed like you landed on poetry. Like, it seemed like you were doing a lot of stuff and you continued to do a lot of stuff, but poetry seemed to be the thing. Was that a decision you made at some point? Like, this is it.
You know, I wanted to be an artist. That's what I wanted.
Period.
And to me, an artist was the whole spectrum.
Right.
And, you know, I dreamed of being a painter and I always wrote. And I wrote poetry since I was about 14.
Yeah.
And, but when I first came to New York working at a bookstore, Robert and I lived in a little apartment and I did little drawings, but it was really the lion's share of my energy went into poetry. And that's really how I wound up performing or and recording later. It's all the poetry was the genesis. Like even Horses, the first lines of Horses
right.
is from Gloria is from a poem I wrote in 1970.
Right.
And Redondo Beach came from a poem. A lot of the idea of improvising came from the way I wrote and performed poems. So I guess I've always been, you know, poetry centric when it comes to my work. Even now when I write a lot less poetry, I still feel it invading my books. Like in Year of the Monkey or any of these books that I write,
yeah,
I'll read something and I'll think, you know, that's three quarters poem, but.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. There's a, like, I ended up like last night, I don't know, I was listening to like Tangerine Dream, you know, reading the.
That's so awesome.
Reading the rest of your book. And like, you know, I'd read like over half of it already, but I've got Tangerine Dream on. I'm reading your book and all of a sudden I'm like underlining shit. I'm like, this is poetry. Yeah. There's I definitely see parts where, you know, if you just spaced it differently, they just, it'd be poetry.
A lot of the poetry I wrote when I was younger was love centric or relationship centric or, you know, and it's just as I got older, I don't write so much of that anymore. So I find myself, gravitating almost completely to prose.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that, like, you know, what you just said about, you know, you wanted to be an artist and an artist is all of it. And I think it seems to me like even in that, this being your first Zoom, and I'm very excited to be part of a Patti Smith first.
It is. And it's not so bad. I have to say I was a little worried about it. I thought, well, I don't know. I just didn't know what to expect. But yeah. It's
all right.
It's fun so far.
It works.
Yeah.
But like,
yeah.
When you talk about being a full artist and that, you know, that you had to do all these things, whatever it was, that there is this general sense of the artist and art. I was talking to my buddy, Sam Lipsight, last night. He's a writer, a genius. I love him. And, you know, it struck me that, you know, even, you know, that you don't Zoom, you don't have the headphones and you live the life of an artist. But you also, it seems to me in reading the books that you look to art to resolve all the fundamental questions of existence. You look to art for relief. You look to art to make sense of the world. You look to it when you're just hanging out, having coffee. That there's is almost a religiosity to what it can do for somebody if they surrender to it wholly and fully. And it seems that's the life you live.
Well, that's, thank you. That's really a nice thing to say. But I think it's also, I look at, when I was very young, I always looked at that one is called to be an artist.
Yes.
If you have a calling to be a poet, well, it could be anything, it could be a priest or a musician or
comedian.
A doctor. I mean, it's, you know, one has a calling.
Yeah.
But, you know, I felt like it was my calling. I've never wanted to do anything else. I don't really, not that adept to do anything else. It's been a part of my life, my whole life. And even when I was very ill, anytime I've been very ill or at the, you know, at the brink of despair, it always comes to me. It always gives me refuge, or it always gives me a voice. It always, or makes me feel that I have some worth, you know, that I have something, you know, to offer the canon of art, or offer to people, or offer to the future. And it's just, but you know, I think of all of these things are linked together. If one has a calling, where does the calling come from? You know, one can say from God, from nature, you know, from some kind of vast energy pool. And I believe in those things. I mean, how I believe in it shifts as I evolve, but I've always connected. Art for me has not been a godless pursuit. So I have it all within my work. I have connections with everything within my work. But I've also understood that being an artist, you know, there's certain amount of sacrifice, and also there's a certain amount of self orientation. I mean, self-centeredness in being, it's not, I'm not talking about being conceited. I'm just right. talking about that you become a sort of work and one's own work centric, creative,
of course,
creative centric, which can be at the detriment to how much time or how much of yourself you give to others. So there is, you know, it's not like it's the most benevolent of all the vocations, but it's the one I got.
It's interesting because I feel a calling. I feel like I had a calling and I felt like I had no choice but to be a stand-up comic. I mean, that was it. Like there was no other thing to do. So, you know, that's what I did and I do. Well, there's other things we do. I do this now, but whatever. But it's the ability to identify the calling and then actually have it in your brain that you have no other option is some sort of strange, commitment that I can't explain it. But maybe it's a God thing. It's a spiritual thing. But like there's literally when you have it and you honor it, you're like, there are no other choices. And then when shit gets tough, you're like, well, I guess I'm just fucked or else it's going to get me out of this. I don't know. I have no idea.
I also think that for myself, I've been very lucky because lucky or unlucky, because it's almost like I have I live in a constant fork in the road, and I'm always going up this road or that road, because one great part of me as a performer is entrenched in collaboration, public life, right. collaboration with a crew, with technology, with the people, with my band. It's entirely collaborative, and it's very outgoing, and then the other part of me requires no one, and desires no one. The writer part of me, it really requires no technology. I mean, I can get a notebook and a pencil. I can be off by myself. I don't need anything. I don't need anyone, and I keep vacillating or going back and forth to these two vocations, which is, again, why the first months of this, of our lockdown was difficult, because I had my bags packed. I was going on a world tour, a whole year of touring. I got myself ready for that. It was my gift to my people, because at 73, it's, one can start questioning how long you're going to be doing this. And I was ready for that. My whole psyche was ready for that, to be outgoing, to be more giving, to be more open with people. And then suddenly lockdown in solitude and stationary, which I wasn't mentally or physically prepared for. So I was quite restless, to say the least, but I've gotten into a groove.
Yeah, I mean, I see the Instagram stuff. You seem to be kind of like at least writing daily, taking pictures.
I am writing daily, but the first couple months, I didn't write as much as I wished. I had to the first couple of months was really getting a new mindset, reprogramming myself to suddenly being alone, to being in one place, not going anywhere, not doing anything publicly. So it was, I had to retune, but I'm doing my work.
You are. Yeah. You seem good. I mean, you can do these Zoom calls with anybody, Patty. Like if you get used to this, you can hang out with people like this.
It's really funny. It's just, I saw my kids did this once and they asked me to sit in it.
Yeah.
And I was like, for like 3 minutes. This is my first. I mean, I did that, but this is the first all by myself doing it with figuring it out and pressing the right thing and everything. Yeah. I lasted about 4 minutes and I was like, I'll be right back. They're my kids and I love my kids, but it was like all this talking and all these faces that I was like, let me out of here.
Yeah. The other thing, when you were talking about art and about, about writing and about choosing writing, that writing becomes the primary as you get older. Is that what you're able to do? I mean, it's certainly in this book and Just Kids as well, is, you know, you're able to take your experience with people you love and people you respect. And then, you know, as they pass on, you know, you integrate them into the universe of your own creativity through, you know, how you represent them in these books. You know, they become characters that, you know, none of us knew. Like, I didn't know Sandy at all, you know, but like I had when I went and looked him up and I saw the work he did, I saw the records he produced. I hear what you had to say, but you're sort of interpreting of their moving on, of their passing. It creates another world for their existence. It's a beautiful thing. But it seems like, you know, that you are doing a lot of reckoning with this loss business, you know.
Well, I have my whole life. It seems to be something that, you know, and especially in the past, well, I've just had a string of losses, you know.
Yeah.
My pianist, Robert Mapplethorpe, my brother, my husband, my parents, and just so many friends, and Sam and Sandy in one year it was quite a blow. But I know I think Robert asked me to write Just Kids. I would have never written that book, ever. I never wanted to write nonfiction. I just wanted to write fiction and poetry. Robert asked me to write it the day before he died, and I promised I would. And it took me over 10 years to write it. And but what I was trying to do was give people Robert as a human being, you know, right, with his idiosyncrasies and, you know, his work ethic, the way, how funny he was, how loving he was, or I think he wanted to be remembered more spectrally, but he also knew he could trust me.
Right.
You know, Robert and Sam was alive when I wrote M Train. Sam is in M Train.
Yeah.
He's in the M Train as himself, and he's in M Train as my sort of like guardian angel cowpoke writer. And he loved this. He saw himself in Just Kids, and he knew that I presented him as we were. And that's what he said to me. I said, "Were you mad? Were you okay with what I wrote?" And he said, "It was just like it was."
Yes.
And, I like giving people, I like sharing my people, with everyone. Right now I'm writing about my brother. Very few people knew my brother. My brother was an extraordinary person. He died when he was 42. And I just want people to know him. And I don't even know what to say. I feel like you put a mirror up to me and I'm thinking, oh, should I be doing that or what? But it
of
is.
Of course. Of course you should be doing it. It's like, I was sort of amazed because, you know, I recently lost somebody that I loved tragically and quickly, and reckoning with loss, you know, I've never had to do it. You know, this is the first time, like, you know, my parents are still fucking alive, you know, and, you know, and this woman was, you know, my girlfriend, and she was in my house, you know, and I never had to deal with that, the trauma, the tragedy, and then the absence, you know, living with the absence. So what do you do with that? So I felt, you know, especially reading, you know, this and reading, you know, parts of Just Kids, that, you know, it seems that you are integrating, you know, that absence into, you know, what life is. I mean, it's obvious, there's nothing unusual about loss and about death. It's the most common thing in the world, but it's like, it's really a lot to deal with, but it's perfectly human.
Well, I also like, I, a lot of my relationships, a lot of my friendships would be long distance. You know, we wouldn't see each other for a while. So, you know, but I always felt them with me. I always felt Sam with me when I traveled.
Yeah.
If I didn't see him for a couple of months, I knew him for half a century. I knew that he was in my corner. I was in his. And, you know, it doesn't feel any different. I do long to see him I mean, he was such a beautiful man and he was so protective, and I just, his presence, I miss his physical presence more than I could have imagined. But I also feel, you know, I'm sure I'll write something else again and he'll be back again.
Yeah. You keep bringing him back.
You know, he's because he'll always be with me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see why he shouldn't be with me.
Right, you know? Of course. Yeah. And Lenny and you have been together for a million years now, right?
Yes, I met Lenny not long after I met Sam. Lenny and Sandy were very good friends as well. We all knew each other.
Sandy was like Sandy Pearlstein, right? Is that Pearlman?
Pearlman, yeah.
Pearlman was the manager and producer of Blue Oyster Cult for a lot of records.
Yes, and he wrote a lot of their songs. He wrote a lot of their lyrics and the concepts.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of those songs, Astronomy, a Star. I wrote some of the lyrics. I wrote Career of Evil and some of the other ones. But the night I met Sandy was my first poetry reading, and I was with Sam. And Lenny did a little guitar with me, played some feedback on some poems. And Sandy Pearlman came up to me and told me I should be fronting a band and asked me if I wanted to come and audition to sing, to be the other singer with Eric on what became Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
At the time, they were called Stalk Forest at the time. Uh-huh. But and I just thought that was, I thought it was really funny. I mean, I said, this guy said the funniest thing to me. And he said, I don't think that's so funny. You could do that. You know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But that was February 71. And I wasn't even thinking about doing anything like that. I wanted to, you know, I think I had my first poetry book and, you know, I was very, poetry was my vocation that I was magnifying. Never even occurred to me.
Down the St. Mark's Poetry Project? Is that what it was called? Yeah. It's weird, the convergence of, like, you know, that scene and the punk rock scenes all sort of like swirling around, and then it just blows up. The weird thing is about you is, like, I'm listening to you, you know, from Horses and, you know, the first three records. It's like, you know, you're a fucking rock star. I mean, that shit holds up. And, like, you know, whatever you were doing, and like with the poetry or whatever, you know, when you sing on those songs, or when I saw you perform here in L.A. a couple of years ago at that small club, remember when Johnny Depp came up and I think Joe Perry was there? That was a good show. You were great.
Thank you.
You rocked hard. But like when I see you do that or I listen to those records, I'm like, this is, you know, you're a singular force in rock and roll. I mean, I'm sure the poetry was great, but was there a certain amount of relief when you started to do rock and roll?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why it happened, because I got bored really quickly. You know, I mean, just reading poems, I had so much energy. I had really 78 speed, natural energy.
Yeah.
You know, I was just a wired kid, and I couldn't really be contained easily.
Yeah.
And, I found that, you know, it happened. It started slow, but when it started happening and I started improvising over three chords,
yeah,
I could just spew language. And plus I liked, you know, the physicality of it. And but, you know, I was still thinking of it as poetry.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't thinking you know, of that I was like a rock and roll singer. I didn't have any, you know, visions of me singing. I was a performer. I still think of myself as a performer. But when it evolved to rock and roll and we were recording and going on the road, of course, you know, I loved rock and roll. Rock and roll saved my life when I was a kid. You know, being part of the evolution of rock and roll was helped form me. And I wanted to be like the best, you know, if I was going to be even a minor rock and roll star, I was going to be a good one. I don't mean even talented. I just mean I would put all of my everything into being, like, you know.
All in. The real deal.
Yeah. Because, yeah, you know, who wants to be a mediocre rock star?
Nobody. there's a lot of them around, though. So when you, like, who were... I mean, it's pretty, you have pretty specific rock heroes though, don't you? That kind of compelled you.
Well, I mean, I was, for me, I mean, I loved Jim Morrison, and, you know, I love Bob Dylan, of course. Bob Dylan was a very important and mentor from afar for me. But one of the people that I learned so much from was Johnny Winter.
Really?
Well, because I got a job for a while with Steve Paul. Steve Paul wanted to sign me up to his record. He opened up a record company in 1971 called Blue Sky Records.
Yeah.
And he wanted to give me a record contract.
Yeah.
In 1971. And but he wanted to form me.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to groom me. And he offered me a lot of money. And I said, I ain't doing that. I actually talked to William Burroughs about that. I said, this guy offered me like huge amount of money, but it's not something I want to do. And he said, you know, you got to keep your name clean. You got to never do anything that you know isn't right for you.
Keep your name clean. Wow.
So I wanted a different job. So I didn't take that, but I took a different job from him, sort of shadowing Johnny Winter when they went, they had to go to England because Johnny was colorblind. And they needed somebody with them to go, walk, cross the streets, look at the traffic lights and roam around with him. And Johnny liked me because Johnny lived at the Chelsea Hotel for a while and Robert designed some of his clothes. So I started going to some of Johnny's concerts. Well, he wasn't like anybody that I would have thought I would have liked.
Yeah.
I mean, I was Jimi Hendrix, all Jimi Hendrix all the time.
Yeah.
But I saw Johnny live many times. And I have to say, 1970, 71, 72, I never saw anybody like him. Anyone as fierce as him. He would leap, the first person I ever saw that leaped into the people.
Uh-huh.
Leaped into the people would leap right off the stage. He commanded that whole stage. And the energy that guy had and his body language was like nothing I ever saw. He was like a wizard.
Yeah, yeah. He
wasn't my favorite guy. I mean, it wasn't even like my kind of music, but his physicality, and I learned a lot from him.
Yeah, he's a monster guitar player. I mean, he's like, and always was.
He was almost bewitched. Yeah. It was like he was like bewitched. I learned a lot from him. I learned a lot, of course, you know. I modeled myself a little after Bob Dylan, and you know, I wasn't embarrassed about, you know, modeling myself after these guys.
Bob Dylan modeled himself after Ramblin' Jack Elliott for years.
But I was myself, but I got certain things from these people. I got certain things I know from Jimi Hendrix, or I got certain things from Lotta Lenya.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
So I just took the things from masters because I had no training. I had no musical training. I didn't replicate them. I just absorbed what I could learn from them.
Of course.
And just did
the thing. Yeah, because like I can't, like it becomes seamless. And, you know, you take the magic of the heroes and you integrate them into your sense of self and confidence, and then you kind of bloom into your own thing. You know, you don't become them, but you know, it's definitely magic. I like the way you characterize Johnny, that you just saw that he was a vessel. You know what it was, but it was in there, you know.
And also he was fearless. I saw Jim Morrison, and Jim Morrison, he was awesome, but he like pushed things as far as he could, but he always seemed afraid.
Interesting.
I thought of him as a very paranoid style performer. He seemed, because he had, you could feel, I don't know what, his own demons, whatever he feared.
Yeah.
I was a young girl. I saw him in 1968 or something, or 67. But what I got from him wasn't the same thing I got from Johnny.
Right.
I got, you know, he had, you know, I'm sure sometimes he might have felt like a god, Jim Morrison, but you also felt a self-loathing or something. He had a strange,
right.
He lacked self-love, I think. And I can't say that I understood him, but his style didn't appeal to me.
Right. Right.
You know, I looked at him and I thought, I didn't feel intimidated by his presence.
Right. Well, it seems like with Johnny, and even I can see that with you, that, you know, you're all in, and you're not afraid of the vulnerability of being all in. Like, this is it. You know, it's going to be awkward for some of you, but this is what it is. Right.
Well, I just think all the thing that I wanted for our band and for myself was just that we were ourselves.
Right.
You know, that, however flawed, I don't know, even that sometimes when I was awkward or sometimes when it seemed like I was like and acted like an asshole, it didn't matter. It was all, you know, I hate to use the word authentic. It's just, we didn't have any artifice.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
And if I sensed artifice or because of repetition, you know, a lack of complete engagement, then I would like mentally counsel myself about that, because I didn't want that. I just wanted, and I just thought of another great performer.
Who?
Bob Marley. What a great performer.
Oh yeah.
Oh my. He was an awesome performer. He was another one that had, you could feel him. It was like shamanistic. You could feel him entered.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just beautiful energy.
Yeah.
It's all about energy.
Sure. Well, what about some of your contemporaries? What do you think of Iggy?
Well, he was Iggy came out before. He came in the 60s.
Oh, did he?
Iggy's
I guess
a performer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
I guess, yeah, he's younger. And Lou Reed, too, is older, too. You're younger than those guys. But they were around, right? They left their mark on the city.
Iggy just started younger.
Yeah,
I mean, he was started in the 60s after the MC5.
Yeah.
I didn't, I never even saw Iggy before until later in life. You know, he wasn't on my radar.
Uh-huh.
You know?
That's all, yeah, because I guess your husband, Iggy, used to hang around their house or something, right?
Well, I mean, my husband, I didn't know about, you know, I was from South Jersey. I didn't even hear about the Velvet Underground there. You know,
yeah.
It was like, I came to New York and had to learn a lot about our present culture.
Right.
And I didn't know anything about the MC5 or,
right.
or Fred. Or,
yeah.
You know, when I first saw Fred, I just saw him as a guy,
yeah.
You know, across a crowded room, and that was that, you know.
Yeah. And how are your kids? Good?
My kids are great. My daughter works tirelessly for climate change awareness. She is a nonprofit, mm-hmm. and she's a musician, and she writes. And my son is a great guitar player. And as a family, they're awesome. My kids are just they magnify the best of their father, and I see myself somewhat in them. And you know, I love my kids.
It's great.
Sometimes we all play on stage together, and I love my kids because they're always my kids.
Yeah.
I mean, my son has come up. We were playing. I think we were in Spain or something. There was like 30,000 people at a festival, and my son was playing lead guitar that night, and we were on some song, I can't remember. I'm singing the chorus, and then there was a breakdown, and my son is going, "Mom, Mom, Mom," and I'm going like, what is it? And he was saying, I'm having a little rough time. He was having a little rough time physically. He said, I don't know what kind of solo I'll be doing, but I'll just do the best I can. And I said, yeah, just do the best you can, Jack. But we're like talking. He's always my son,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm always his mom, you know? And,
yeah.
And of course, he played great. But he's, you know, I remember also we were touring with Bob Dylan, and some reporter, you know, asked him, what's it like having your mom as your mom? And he goes, she's my mom. You know, she makes dinner and she's, you know, washes the clothes. And that was the best answer of all. I don't want to be anything else but mom to my kids.
Well, it seems like you had a lot of time there where you could really focus for a while, right?
Well, they were quite young when they lost their father, but 6 and 12. But when their father was alive, we were always with each other every day because Fred and I both left public life and we lived very simply. And we were always together. You know, so we have a lot to remember.
Yeah.
You know, we have all of that time together.
Good foundation. Remember.
But also my daughter plays piano and she sounds like Fred.
Wow.
And my son, sometimes he's playing guitar and just sometimes the faces he makes or the tones that he draws, which are very unique.
Yeah.
Were very unique to Fred. And I've stood on stage and actually almost burst into tears hearing my son play. It's so much would sound just like his father.
Wow.
And he wouldn't even be conscious of it.
Wow. I bet you some of that stuff is just in there. It's just carried on.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's been proven to me.
Yeah.
That, there's so many ways that we become who we are, you know, from the people that nurture us and from, you know, experience and what we study and all of the influences that we have, but also blood can be a gift too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I definitely believe that's true. And another Jersey guy, Bruce, are you friends with Bruce?
Well, I mean, I know him. I mean, we don't hang out or anything.
No buddies.
We see each other. We're happy to see each other, but yeah, I mean, I'm also not, I'm not really a musician. I don't really have a musician's lifestyle or hang out with, you know, musicians. I mean, even when Lenny and I are together, we're like two bums that, you know, writer bums that also,
old friends hanging out. Yeah. And the Dylan thing, is he present in your life?
Bob?
Yeah.
Believe me, if Bob was present in my life, that no one would hear about it because he is the most private man you can imagine. But no, Bob is not in my life except in my the way that he is. He's been in my life since I was 15 years old. And I've had time when I've gotten to talk to him a lot or sit and listen to him play and then years not, you know, I don't have any established relationship with him. He knows I'm in his corner. Yeah, so
right. How did the, I'm sure you've told this story, but I don't know. I just watched it. How did the Nobel Prize gig come up?
The Nobel Prize job came because they asked me to, it was the Nobel people. I play a lot in Sweden and actually sort of, you know, well-liked in Sweden.
Yeah.
So the Nobel people asked if I would sing for whoever won the literary who won for the Nobel Prize for Literature. And that year, there was some talk it might be Murakami.
Yeah.
And so I thought I would sing this song, Wing, because of the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. Well, it wasn't. It turned out to be Bob Dylan. And then I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to be singing for Bob. I can't sing one of my songs. I should sing one of his.
Yeah.
So I chose
Hard Rain.
Hard Rain's Gonna Fall because I felt it, even though it was an early song, it encompasses everything.
Yeah.
His poetry, his humanity, his sense of the environment, his sense of, you know, all of the things that he believed, you know, that we all believe in are in that song. And I thought it was the perfect,
yeah, it's great.
Perfect way to introduce him. And of course, I had this terrible episode of strange whiteout nerves,
it is one of the greatest moments of live performing I've ever seen in my life. It is so personal. It's so odd the way it kind of, I know it must have been just horrible for you, but
I thought I would die.
Yeah.
And I don't have any, when it comes to performing, I don't mind screwing up anything. And I screw up a lot, but it's my own screw up.
Yeah.
But to screw up another person's work, especially Bob Dylan, who has meant so much to me throughout right. my whole life. It was terrible.
But the self-correction of it was beautiful because it was ultimately an act of respect. And, you know, but it just that moment where you make the decision to be like, wait a minute, like every time I watch it, I'm like, oh, my God, as a performer, it almost makes me cry because it's like, because it's so honest, though. It's so honest. And, you know, I don't know. I thought it was great. And it seemed like everybody kind of woke up and realized that they were seeing a human. It was kind of an amazing moment.
Well, it seemed universally to strike people that way. And I'm grateful for that because at the moment with the orchestra behind me,
yeah,
a giant, and these cameras, because they were global cameras going all over the world, you know, massive cameras and looking down and the king and queen of Sweden and all of the Nobel laureates and all of this expectation. And then suddenly to just freeze, I just froze. I mean, a song that I knew backwards and forwards just suddenly escaped me. And I didn't know what to do. I've had these things happen to me on stage where I can laugh and make a joke right. and say, well, screw it, like, we'll do this and then talk to the people. I've had paranoid moments where I had to actually talk myself down with the people and say, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I feel really self-conscious. And people are always with you. And I know that people, most of the time, people are with you.
Yeah.
If they come, they are going to be with you.
Right.
It was just... It was so humiliating and so frightening, but it turned out that, you know, it made people seem to identify it because everybody has these moments where their worst moments of their life. Everybody has these moments. And I guess it was just, I guess I had to be the poster girl for the worst moment of your life. But I don't know that I feel about it now like I feel about everything. If it's served anybody, then it's okay.
Yeah,
you know. Isn't it Bob that says you got to serve someone?
Yeah.
So, okay, it seemed to serve people.
Did he say anything about it?
Not to me directly, but I know from the family that everyone seemed very happy. They seemed content with it.
Good.
With everything.
Well, it's great talking to you. I wanted to, you know, I was going to talk more about some of this, like this line, the evidence of an awareness of the relative value of insignificant things. Like it seems that, you know, that like, and I see some of your photographs too, and I have a lot of little things that really become personal magic objects, sort of like, you know, triggers of emotion and nostalgia and place and time. I love that appreciation of that. And I like the way you look at them.
Oh, thank you, Mark. That's so nice. Well, I guess we have to mosey on, but this was really fun.
It was great.
I wish I was sometimes a little more articulate, but I'm just not I've become very mentally abstract in these months, but really fun to talk to.
No, I thought it was great. And I love talking to you. And you know who was always telling me that he wanted us to talk, you know, Barry Skills.
Barry. He's one of my favorite people. He is really, I've been blessed to have him as a crew member and a friend. And I don't know if you know this, but, you know, he has my husband's motorcycle.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. My husband had a Harley Sportster, and Barry and I just had it, you know.
Yeah.
None of us ride a motorcycle, and it was, you know, you can't leave a motorcycle for years not
right.
doing anything, you know. And Barry's dream, I found out, was to have a Harley Sportster.
Yeah.
and he has loved that Barry also, I have to say, reminds me of my late brother, Todd. Uh-huh. So I always say he gets the Toddy Award.
Oh, okay.
And Barry, my brother was the head of our crew when we performed in the 70s. And Barry became the head of our crew when I returned to performing in the 90s. And he has really shepherded that motorcycle. He goes everywhere in it. He named it Sonic after Fred.
Oh, that's great.
I think it's actually, he had it painted on it.
Oh, wow. So. That's great. I didn't know that. Like, I know him from doing Conan as a comic, and he'll work on my guitars occasionally, and we'll talk about this and that. But he's a great guy. But he always used to say, like, look, I'm going to talk to Patty. You guys got to talk.
No, he's been the one. He keeps saying, you have to do this, and you have to do this. And talk about being in one's corner. He is in your corner. That's for sure.
Well, that's sweet. Well, I just want to acknowledge that he's a great guy, and that, you know, he was always championing this, and I'm glad it happened.
Me too. Well, we'll have to do it again sometime, because there's a million things we could talk about.
Yeah.
I can see.
Hopefully in person, you know, like maybe we'll get back to some sense of normal. I'll come to New York with some microphones and we'll do it.
Although I forgot that because any interviews I've done in the past 6 or 7 months have been on the telephone.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at anybody. So actually, I almost forgot that we're not, you know.
Just talking?
It's
great. I'm so happy that we got you involved in the Zoom thing. And it's working out.
Yep.
All right. Well, take care of yourself.
It's officially Zoomed.
You're Zoomed. You've been Zoomed, Patty Smith.
Well, thanks, Mark. Talk to you again soon.
Oh, I love her so much. Patty Smith, the book is You're the Monkey and everything else she's ever done. Go listen to those first 3 or 4 records again, man. Damn. Right out of the gate, just fucking mind-blowing. Dean Del Rey's got AC/DC on Let There Be Talk today. And now I'll play some guitar. Now I'll do it. Cat Angels.